Okay, our first speaker is going to be Sandra Denman from the UK. She's a senior pathologist at the Forest Research. Their main work areas are Phytophthora in particular, Beavermore, and Canovia. And for the past 2 years has been working on acute oak decline in Britain. And she says that's been keeping her very busy. So please welcome Sandra Denman.
Right, here we are. Can you all hear me? No? Yeah, yeah, that's better. Yeah. Whoops. This reminds me, I had to just do a program for the BBC not so long ago, and you know, it's one of these same things where we had the mic and all and so on. And as a TV guy came along, he put this on. He said, "This is the one that George, that Gordon Brown had." I don't know if you guys all saw that. So hopefully this is not the same one. Right. I just have to say that I'm really only the mouthpiece here. I'm not actively involved in the large work myself, although I do a lot on Remorum in any event. So I hope I'm going to do justice to this presentation. This is largely Joan and Clive's work, with Ben Jones strongly in the field. And as I say, I'm a mouthpiece here. So, the story really begins in August 2009 in the Glynn Valley, southwest England, where it was brought to our attention that a number of larch trees were showing dieback and there had been several deaths. So, this triggered a visit to the area in August 2009. It was on Forestry Commission estate land at Plym, and then also at Canonteen and Largan. And in the areas, we also saw a lot of sweet chestnut that looked, you know, had typical symptoms, and there was some beech as well. So samples were taken from the larch, the sweet chestnut, and the beech, but only at Largan. So only at one out of the three sites was there any diseased rhododendron. And just a reminder to you that in Europe and the UK in particular, rhododendron is the main sporulating host for P. remorum. So if we have infected trees there, we usually expect to find infected rhododendron in very close proximity. But this was only true at Largan. So we took that material back to the lab, and the result was that the larch foliage, the beech, and the sweet chestnut bark were all found to be PR positive. But as I pointed out, infected rhododendron was absent at most of these sites, and so this was already quite a big question in our minds as to how this had happened. Just a couple of symptoms. Remember that in August is late summer, coming into early autumn, and remember that larch is a deciduous conifer, so it does have needle drop over the winter. So these were the typical symptoms that we saw, you know, the whole sort of shoot with the needles and the defoliation, that needle drop, and sort of looking very thin and scraggy. Standing back, you could see that it was pretty widespread, that the death and defoliation was pretty widespread in that area, and as you'll notice, just in the foreground, there's some young Douglas fir, and I'll be coming back to that in a minute. So on these larch that were dying back, there were extensive resinous lesions along the stems, some of them up to at least 80 lesions on each stem. Very gummy and really, you know, just a real mess, difficult to work with. Okay, so the accumulating evidence was that wherever larch was found in other nearby understory species were also becoming infected with Phytophthora morum. So this wasn't only a larch problem, although it was in plantation larch, there were a couple of sort of rogue trees, the rogue species like beech and sweet chestnut and so on, just in the area. And these were also becoming infected. So they included the usual suspect hosts in the UK, which were, of course, beech and sweet chestnut. Note, interestingly, sweet chestnut was both a foliar and a bulb canker, and also there was rhododendron. But the thing that really, really unsettled us was that there was this whole suite of new hosts that were becoming infected naturally. And amongst those was birch, Douglas fir, western hemlock, Port Orford cedar, and grand fir. Just having a look at that, birch was a bold host, Douglas fir, bold host, whereas previously that had only really been noted as a shoot tip and perhaps foliage host, western hemlock, bold host, and foliar host, and Port Orford cedar, bold host, grand fir, just a foliar host. Just some examples of this. And for me in particular, this is really quite disturbing because, you know, I was one of the first to notice the symptoms on sweet chestnut on the foliage. And when I found it, that was on epicormic shoots, really, or, you know, on young leaves in the sort of understory of the canopy. This is the whole canopy. So something has changed here. Just look at those infections on the leaves, and as it turned later on in the year, sort of more towards the autumn, those leaves just died. That whole section just died. Look at that birch. Look at that canker on the birch. Really, really serious inner bark dieback, profuse bleeding. This is something that we've not seen. Photograph of the beech a little bit more cryptic, because of the shadows, but up where the arrow is, also quite a serious lesion on the beech. There's the rhododendron, which was just at Largan, and you can see the shoot wilting of the leaves there, showing that that was also was quite an infected, a heavily infected area. Western hemlock. Typically needle blight and defoliation. This looks exactly like we showed in our leaf dip test. So I still think that host tests doing leaf dip and so on, coming up all the time. The results of hosts are coming up afterwards, you know. So the potential host list is there, and now they're starting to come true out in the field, starting to meet the predictions. Okay, the Dagfir. Dagfir, and keep tabs on this throughout the talk because there are developments here. As I said in that first photograph, you could see that this was just a young area of young Douglas fir. And what seemed to be happening is that you would get these little stem cankers which were girdling either the stem or the branch and then causing the entire shoot tip to die back, all these branches to die. As you can see where the arrows are pointing, that is where the original cankered lesion would be, and then the material above that would die. So these are on approximately four-year-old trees, pretty young. Okay, the current situation, I think this is a winter photograph, so it doesn't really do it justice. You know, remember that this is a deciduous conifer. But do notice that the small Douglas fir in front, and look at the age of the infected larch, and it's showing the two areas. I'm not sure what it is in between there. Okay, so moving on now, Dagfir again. This was on another site, a little bit older. Dagfir 5 to 7 years. Once again, those lesions, a little bit more of the tree showing dieback, but taking out those tops quite clearly. So top 2 meters. Also, what Jonah said is that most recently they found quite a mature Doug fir taken out the top 2 meters with a canker. So, large dieback and mortality widespread in some forests in the West Country. Symptoms on affected larch show needle loss. Dieback are fine branches leading to cankers on the main branches and the trunk. This is on mature trees, 25 to 40 years old. They have multiple cankers, quite a wide DBH. More than 80 individual resinous cankers on a stem have been recorded. What's interesting and difficult for us in the lab is that the remorum isolation hit rates have been very low on the larch. And I think that this is really because there's quite a lot of resin which seems to prevent the culturing of it. We've been able to detect it using our LFD tests, but to actually get it into culture is very difficult. They've only had a 10 to 40% success rate in the lab and on the stem cankers, but on the foliar samples, a little bit higher, 30 to 50%. However, remember, we're only 10 months into looking at this problem, and so there could be seasonal effects here which are affecting our recovery rates. What's also really important and highly disturbing is the fact that larch appears to be a sporulating host. And not only is it a sporulating host, but it appears to have profuse sporulation. And I think that this is one of the reasons that we are getting all these other hosts being infected. So, is larch a sporulating host? This is a question. It's a deciduous host, so the time frame for sporulation tests in 2009 was really short. But we did do a little bit of work in the lab. We managed, in October, we managed to harvest the last few sort of live green shoot tips of larch that were about 12 centimeters long. And these were dipped with Zeus-4 suspension of P. remorum. We had both a wounded and a non-wounded treatment. And each shoot was maintained in water. In other words, the little shoots were stood in a vial of fresh water so that they could stay alive. And they were incubated in moist chambers under high humidity. And we had our controls with positive controls, rhododendron leaves. And after 7 to 10 days, these were assessed. The outcome of these tests showed that wounding was not required for infection. But there were various categories of symptomatic or disease expression. We had blackened and brown needles, usually infected, which was confirmed by back isolation. And then we had sort of this chlorotic banded effect with needles. We had sort of yellow and green banding, and these were rarely infected. There was occasional evidence of asymptomatic infection, so that was straight off green needles. Having a look at these inoculated material through the microscope, we could see both sporangia and chlamydospores were visible on the surface of the needles, as well as when we took a section, they were actually embedded in the tissue. What's really frightening is that the sporangia numbers ranged from tens to thousands per needle. And one needle is, you know, it's only an inch long, and it's very narrow, and there's many needles coming out of one bud. There's many buds on one shoot. Okay. So, in any event, what we need to do is look again this season, starting in 2010, and have a look at the shoots. I just have a few photographs to show of that sporulation. For me, the one on the top right-hand side says the story. You can see particularly in the lower section, all those little darkly stained things are sporangia, each one stained dark. You know, this is taken through probably a times 10 or times 20 view, so your field of view here is minuscule. Okay, the next step. So what are we doing about it? Well, there's wide-scale felling in the West Country at the moment to remove these infected larch that they wanted to do before bite burst this spring to counter another flush of foliar sporulation. But this raised a whole lot of problems because of the potential for transmission. And, you know, when this situation hit, I think everybody was a little bit unprepared for it. We weren't sure of how we were going to deal with it. And so the potential for transmission, suddenly it came, you know, via the timber, via the people working on the site, the machinery. Suddenly we had 10,000 trees felled that were unscheduled. What did we do with the timber? And the biosecurity measures loomed large. These are just a few points which I managed to, you know, document regarding the biosecurity measures that we took at the time. The public were asked to stay away from the area, particularly when felling. This wasn't that unusual because normally when felling, the public are asked to stay away in any event. But somehow, you know, when things leak out, then the public have a great curiosity. In any event, they were asked to stay away. The people working on site, there was disinfection of boots and machinery. Just using on the machinery, they were only using hosing down. There wasn't any chemical application at the time. The brush was left behind on site. There was quite an issue about burn. Should we be using burn as a method of controlling residual inoculum in those shed needles? Unfortunately, I think there's a very high risk of fire, and this remains a huge issue for us to deal with, is how to deal with the inoculum that's residing in those leaves. The mills that receive the felled material, they're not licensed per se, but they must meet certain criteria regarding the treatment of timber, bark, and sawdust. Some of them are using the bark and the sawdust as biofuel. Some of them are chipping as residue, and I think they're putting it into composite boarding. Others have been using some of the timber and so on for fencing, but that is treated with a preservative. So some of the issues that remain for us are the overwintering on affected trees, overwintering in the buds. So far there's little or no evidence of this, but we've only really, you know, had one season under this magnitude of activities, and we have a very small team that's been able to deal with this. Clearly there's an issue about long-term containment on these sites. We don't know very much about the time of sporulation, whether it goes throughout the growing season or whether it occurs only at the end of the growing season. Many things to address. Just to give you a little bit of an idea, and actually I did write down, perhaps if I can just leave the post for a minute, because Ben sent me an email first thing this morning giving me the updated maps and information. Of course, it took more than an hour to download, and I had to abort the operation. So the map is not the latest one, I have to say. But what Ben did say is that in the Glynn Valley, there's been more than 30 hectares felled and another 18 hectares under notice to fell. And as we get on a little bit later, I will show you some more things. So these figures that you're seeing here are, you know, completely outdated already. But the top in the dark green shows you the Forestry Commission estate land, and in the light green it shows private woodland ownership. And as I say, those numbers are out of date, they're bigger, the losses. This just shows you the situation in March, where the red is confirmed infection on larch, the blue is suspect infection, and the pale yellow are negative on sites that have been tested. Now we'll compare that a little bit later with the situation shortly. So there you can see some of the felling process that's going on. There's quite a few to just trawl through. Just a few pictures to show the resinous exudate that's pouring down these stems with the little cankerous lesions you can see there on the left-hand side, those dark areas, sunken areas on the stem. this is what the situation looks like. Now, perhaps you can see in the background there, just in front of the trees, can you see along the roadside those lines of the logs that have been felled? You know, one of the issues here is that this was unscheduled, so people weren't expecting this to happen. Suddenly they've got all this material, this is, you know, this lumber, what are they going to do with it? But the other thing is that people have invested in this as a lifetime source of, you know, finance and revenue, and suddenly this is evaporating in front of their eyes. These are some of the practical implications of what's happening here. Pretty scary. They're, I think on site, I think that they're burning some of the bark that they've taken off the logs. Just look at those logs lining the road. Okay, so by the time it got to April now, this is showing the tree should have flushed, so they should be all nice and green and, you know, showing a lot of needles. You can see how thin those canopies are and that the dieback is already present. And, you know, this is plantation stuff. It's almost every tree. Look upwards. There the trees are dying. There the buds. As you can see, the little shoots already dying within a branch. The buds not flushing completely, buds dying. So, from here on, yep, we're all into, you know, low carbon footprinting these days. So, more surveys. So more surveys on the ground did reveal further infection, and so now the Forestry Commission has taken up aerial surveys using helicopters. Right, now I'm going to show you, this gives you an idea. So these are April, so this is just, 2 months ago, not even probably only 6 weeks ago. This is Cornwall, and this gives you an idea of just how extensive that death and dieback is. Since August, this is the situation. Next one is Devon. There it is down the valley, you can see, a bit less extensive. Not every area. This was done in the aerial survey, and then they did a bit of ground truthing, and what they found was not every sort of little die-out patch was in fact a PR positive. In this particular photograph, they showed a fire. There had been fire damage down at the bottom. So ground truthing is quite an important part of the survey work. And once again, there you can see the patchiness in that light green on whatever's your side. Okay, just to show the extent of the dieback. We have quite a few of these. We're very upset about it. Okay, so this then shows the flight path. As I say, obviously this has changed now, but these are the original sort of flight surveys or the pathways that they took showing where those photographs were taken. And the potential new findings. The pink's a little bit difficult to see, but that is the Forestry Commission estate area. The green is privately owned. The red dots are confirmed PRs, and the blue are suspects. So there's quite a lot of work that still needs to be done to go and confirm those sites. And unfortunately, as I say, the situation changes by the hour. So, more surveys on the ground have revealed further infection foci. The aerial surveys are now being extended into southern Wales, and as most of you will know, the reason that I'm giving a talk today is just because a day before I was due to go, we had a confirmation that the larch plantations in Wales have been positive. So this has been ramped up by an order of magnitude now. We thought that it was restricted to the southwest country. This has now gone up into Wales, pretty seriously in Wales. Then tells me that at one site near Swansea in South Wales, There's 150 hectares of Japanese larch plantation that is all infected. So they are now flying aerial surveys right the way up and down the western area of the country. So this map's out of date, as I say. We have much to learn about this pathogen, and on behalf of the team, thank you for listening.
And do we have any questions?
Okay.
Yes. How does this area compare with March in Japan? The environmental situations there. Should the Japanese be notified about this? How would they be notified?
I think that the Japanese know about it. I think they should be very worried about it. I mean, quite frantic, because Japanese larch will be native there.
Okay, are the environments similar? Or is this a part of England that planted warm fire?
Well, the larch plantations extend right the way up the West Country. So although the climate mapping is similar to what, you know, has been shown to be conducive to PR infection, there's obviously quite a temperature range that goes on. But I think also areas of China, you know, and that whole East Asian area would be, you know, a source of worry.
Does this happen in a year? What, I mean, as far as symptoms, if this happens so quickly, what do you think?
Well, you know, this is difficult to work out when exactly it started to take hold. But I think it's probably followed a normal sort of epidemiology curve, and that what happened is in August 2009, it started to reach the tipping point. So in a normal epidemic, you've got a sort of a lag phase and then reaches a tipping point, and I think we're on the way up in that tipping point. You know, the issue here is, how did the inoculum arrive? Because, you know, we've all of our work's usually been associated with infected rhododendron. So when we go and survey an area, you know, if there's no rhododendron in the area, we consider it low risk. Well, this is just moving those goalposts. And at the moment, the current thinking is that this has been by high air drift of inoculum. Russ?
Yeah, two quick questions. You said that your viral flotavirus, do you have a few more specific viral flotavirus, or is this just my talk?
No, we have quite specific ones, I think, for Remorum and Canovia.
And secondly, has this been genotyped?
No. Not yet.
Are there any other questions? We have time for a couple more questions.
So, in my mind, it's been surprising that it took so long. Large is certainly a surprise, although the early pathogenicity tests, artificial, show large to be very susceptible. So again, it's confirmation of that. But the behavior has been written, and it's been this splash dispersal rhododendron thing. And now it's up in the canopy with sporulating hosts. So you've got a Tamox situation with the long-distance dispersal, and it'll provide a very interesting independent test of our epidemiology. Mm. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Thank you, Everett. Yeah, this has taken, you know, it's ramped it up into a different order of magnitude, because suddenly we have a landscape problem. Landscape scale, different epidemic, you know, it's requiring a whole new approach. Quite scary, really.
So for the last couple of days, we've been talking about social implications. Have you moved to some form of compensation, or are you just trying to convince people it's the right thing?
Can't
to do?
Say. Sorry. I don't know those details, to be quite honest. I only know the kind of, you know, hard science here. I don't really know you know, I don't imagine really that people are getting any compensation for this, because I think that, you know, that there is some monetary value in the lumber. But, you know, I don't know what they're going to be doing about that. There's a lot of meetings going on right now. That's all I can tell you, emergency meetings.
And are you doing any stream lowers or just relying on your aerial protection process?
They are doing some stream monitoring, yes.
Thank you very much.